And I'm going to make the screen bigger for us. There we go. And let's talk about our lesson today. So this is continuing on from last lesson, obviously. And we're going to look at some patterns of usage here and how when we want to accomplish certain things in language, we format our language in a certain way. So we use a certain type of structure that is going to accomplish what we want to accomplish with it. I know that sounds abstract right now, but I'm going to show you examples of it, and then it's going to make sense because I think intuitively you actually know how this works. You just haven't broken it down yet before. So we'll look at it in a second. Okay. We'll talk about first coordinating conjunctions, and these are our so-called fanboys for and, nor, but, or, yet, and so. These do not indicate subordinating clauses, subordinate clauses. They instead coordinate clauses, as they're called. There's an exception here with so, and so being multifunctional. When it works as a subordinating clause, or when it works to introduce a subordinating clause, we could replace it with so that. But otherwise, they're coordinating clauses, and that's what they do. We know all the other ways that we can introduce subordinate clauses. So some examples here. With coordinated conjunctions, we can do certain things. We can elaborate on our message. Tom kept quiet. He said nothing. We can extend our message. Tom kept quiet, but Ed spoke out. And we can enhance our message. Tom was afraid, and so he kept quiet. We can also do the same thing with subordinating conjunctions. So elaborating, we could use the subordinating conjunction which. Tom kept quiet, which was unusual. We can extend our message. Tom kept quiet, whereas Ed spoke out. And Tom kept quiet because he was afraid would be enhancing our message. But with subordinating conjunctions, we've got a subordinate clause that's going to depend on the main clause. In the coordinated conjunction box here, we've got two main clauses. They're not, one's not dependent on the other. I think maybe later on we should talk about people starting sentences with which. Maybe this is something you noticed. Is that something on the rise? People just starting with this subordinating conjunction, which, I don't know. We can talk about that after we get through our lesson, maybe. Okay, let's look at some non-clausal elements. So clauses contain clearly identifiable subjects and predicates. This is what I was telling you about before we started the recording for this lesson, when we talked about embedding. And you know, if you have a clause as say the direct object, you're embedding something with a subject and a predicate into another clause that has its own subject and predicate, and you can clearly recognize these things, especially when you think about something like say reporting verbs. When you report speech and you have something like, I don't know, who do we have on the last slide there, Tom and Ed, you know, we have something like Tom said that Ed likes cats, or something like that. Ed's going to be the subject of that clause embedded as direct object. Likes is going to be the predicate, etc. Non-clausal language does not include these things. We have different types of non-clausal language, mostly in spoken interaction, because, well, spoken language doesn't have these kinds of strict confines that written language has. Spoken interaction There's meaning derived from many more things, including sort of body language and pitch and tone and just general, you know, situational knowledge, what's going on, but and knowledge between the two people that you don't have in writing. It's kind of impossible to have in writing, so that you need to kind of spell everything out in writing. Spoken language doesn't necessarily need that. And also spoken language, since it's online, and that's the word they use for it. They say online, not like it's on the internet, but spoken language is online. There can be back and forth, and there can be, you know, you can ask for something to be repeated. You can ask for something to be explained better, all this kind of stuff. We do sometimes get non-clausal language in written text, and you might see, you know, they talk about texting sort of, this is a kind of a can of worms that I don't want to open up in this course right here, but they talk about texting as if it's more like spoken language than say, you know, journalism or, you know, fiction or academic writing or something like that. And yeah, fine. Okay. So you might see more non-clausal language in texting, for example. Some examples here, you know, something like, oh my God, shit, man, true, something like this. You can see these could be responses to something somebody says. So, all right, let's do a little exercise here. I'm going to pause the recording in a second. I'll tell you when, and I'll type it in the chat. But we want to identify which the following contain clausal and non-clausal material. Okay, so we've got this with facts. The possibilities are endless. It can send a document anywhere in the States within minutes, including drawings, diagrams, even musical notes, exactly as it is written. Facts worth making a song and dance about. Let's pause the recording. No, hold on. Okay, recording back on. So we looked at the answers for these, which ones have clause elements or non clausal material and non-clausal material. We ended up with facts having it. And the answers are on the Moodle page now as well. Let's go on here. Okay, let's talk about sentences and utterances. Sentences consist of one clause or a combination of clauses. This is something I'm sure you've heard me harp upon, whether we should use this term or not. And if you liked listening to me harp on it earlier, then you're going to love what's coming up right now. The sentences, I mean, the definition of a sentence is that it typically begins with a capital letter and ends with a punctuation mark, such as a period or a question mark or a exclamation point. And even like there used to be a course at our university and the teacher would ask in the beginning, in the first lesson, the teacher would ask, what's a sentence and write it down, write down your definition and then go through all the different ways of thinking about it. And then at the end, tell people to look at it and see if their definition had changed, and it really hadn't. And I mean, that's kind of our definition that we would work with. The thing is though, this really places sentence in the domain of written language because there are no capitals in spoken language, there are no letters in spoken language, and there are no punctuation marks in spoken language. I mean, I can say full stop or period, and of course I can yell, which is, you know, a thing that existed before writing. And of course writing, it would be trying to sort of mimic some of these things of spoken language with capital letters and whatnot. So, all right, sentence, fine, great, does us good when we're looking at written language, but we know that, you know, spoken language is the language, and there's much, much more spoken language than there is written language. So maybe we want something else. We want to look at instead something like utterance. An utterance is maybe something more like a for spoken language. So we can call an utterance a stretch of spoken language between pauses. There's other ways of defining it, and especially if you go into other fields in linguistics, they might define it differently. But what we're thinking about here is that utterance is something we define independently of grammatical structures, such as a clause or writing conventions, such as sentence. So sentence is something that we don't define independently of writing conventions, but utterance we do. And structurally, utterances may be clauses, but they can also be nothing like clauses. So by definition, they're not called sentences. Now, when we start to look into the patterns I was talking about at the beginning and what we try to accomplish when we use language and when we form language in a certain way, make certain structures to do certain things, we want to look first at our clause types, so we have a good understanding of ways of describing the language. And we've got on your table here, you've got your different moods. You got your declarative mood, interrogative mood, and imperative mood. This interrogative mood is usually broken up into two. And I think I maybe have a table where it is, but certainly in the Downing book, you'll find it. Declarative mood is the kind of default way of default form of language. So when you hear something like, well, we heard already English is a subject verb object language. We heard that already when we were talking about Yoda and Yoda's grammar. When you hear something like that, what they mean is that declarative mood or statements are in subject verb object form. Okay, so declarative mood form is statement. And what it does is, it's kind of function, what it's trying to accomplish is to give information or to assert something, make a statement. Interrogative mood, we know, is questions, asking for information or asking for something, asking, eliciting information, something like that. And then your imperative mood, which is directives. This is for giving orders, suggestions, making requests. This imperative one is the one that's not going to have an overt subject, usually. What we're looking at with this table, though, is a form-function relationship. The key word in this this little box here, though, is highly generalized, meaning extremely abstract, meaning this it doesn't always have to work like this. And once we start looking at some examples, you'll see that, okay, it doesn't always work like that anyways. I mean, just think about some of the conversations you've had recently, or maybe sort of an intense conversation you've had, and think about the way that somebody put, the way that somebody said something, you know, could have been a question, but was it really a question? Maybe they were actually trying to assert something. So, okay, so from a pragmatic standpoint, what we want to do is we want to identify the form and the function in the context. And context is, you know, what's going on around the language. So if it's written down, we call it like the co-text. If not, we would call it, you know, the interaction. But what's going on around it? We want to know who are the people using language? What are they trying to do? What's the situation? Maybe their age, their situation in relation to each other. Are they family members? Are they... well, we'll look at an example coming up. So a little bit about pragmatics, which I think maybe a lot of you already know something about. Anyone have any courses on pragmatics? If you haven't had any courses on pragmatics, maybe do so, because it's cool and people generally, when they study pragmatics, they're like, oh yeah, this is cool. This is like what I think about when I think about studying language. I mean, you get dumped into these grammar courses when you're in your first couple of years at the university. But when you're thinking about studying language, you're probably the way pragmatics studies language, but whatever. What pragmatics is trying to understand meaning in context. So what speakers are trying to accomplish based on what they say and how they say and in the situation that they say it. This goes back to, some of the early work in pragmatics is called speech act theory. And speech act theory talks about different acts, locutionary act, elocutionary act, and perlocutionary act. And perlocutionary act is the important one here for us because it's the act performed by saying something. So the effect that gets produced on the hearer when you say something. So if somebody says, I wish I had a thicker coat, say A says, I wish I had a thicker coat, B understands, person A is cold in here, I need to close the window. They're not actually wishing they had a thicker coat, right? They're not actually making a statement or asserting that a thicker coat is something I long for, or that if a genie came out right now and granted me one wish, I would wish for a thicker coat. No, what they're trying to say is, of course, a roundabout way, the act they're performing is saying that, will you close the window without asking them to do that? Okay, let's think about social situations and formats. And we're going to look at something from Cooper Coolin. And the idea here is that there are different linguistic formats which are used to perform different kinds of social actions. I mean, this is another way of saying what I was kind of leading up to already in this lecture when I was talking in the beginning about trying to get something done with language and putting language a certain way to get it done. So the idea is that we have certain linguistic formats that perform certain jobs in interaction. And this social action is what's called the main job of a turn here. And I promise the examples are coming up very soon. I think they're on the next slide, actually. So there's a tendency to use specific linguistic formats to do specific jobs and actions. And I think this, when you think about it, this probably makes all the sense in the world because language, we learn language at least partly. I don't know where anybody stands on the sort of native nurture side of things, but we learn language at least partly from using language with other people. And if we see, if we experience other people doing things with language in a certain way, then we know what that means. And if we want to do the same thing with language, then we will formulate our language in the same way. So let's look here, examples. So we've got, before I go through this, I'm going to back up and I'm going to give you a little lightning round explanation of transcription practices. If anybody has done transcription, then you'll know what I'm talking about here and maybe chime in if I miss anything. But if you haven't done transcription here, spoken language is language. Written language is something else. It's something that comes later. The only thing is that spoken language is hard to analyze. It of course disappears as soon as it's said. If it's recorded, then we have to work with the recording. And only until pretty recently was that at all easy. Especially, with digital technologies, you can jump around in a recording very easily now. But before, that wasn't very easy at all. So instead, and you'll still see this, is ways of writing out the transcription so that we can also indicate things that typical written language does not indicate, such as who's talking over somebody, such as pauses and how long they are, stress, all different kinds of things. You'll see more things added to the transcription. So in here, we've got the interaction at the top. It's Jerry and Shirley. So there's two people talking here. Shirley has been asking her friend Jerry about what plans she has for seeing her out-of-town boyfriend again. Jerry has explained that she may not see him until Thanksgiving or perhaps even Christmas. And Jerry starts first. And we see Jerry says, and it doesn't matter at this point. I've waited this long. I can wait. And when Jerry says can wait, Shirley talks over her and says, can wait another 3 weeks. Jerry says, yeah, the colon in there is to indicate the pause. And Shirley has this sort of breath, breathes out for 0.2 seconds. She says, well, that's good. More like a, well, that's good. And then goes on and says, yeah, no. And then this is, we're going to look at this one later. Maybe if he, she says, I'm not sure he'll be around for Christmas, won't he? And Jerry says, oh, yeah, he'll be down here for Christmas. When she says for Christmas, Jerry says, good, maybe we can get together for dinner. And Jerry says, mm-hmm. And then Jerry, sure. And there's something there. But what we're looking at is maybe if he, and then maybe we can get together for dinner. So the idea here is what's the form and what's the social action? And if we want to, I'll flip back to our table here. I'll write it in the chat here. Maybe we can get together. So let's go back to our table here. Here we go. So what's the form here? No, it's not an imperative. Here we've got a clear subject, Lee. There's modality going on there, which make things a little bit different. But you're on the right track because the form here equals statement. So it's a declarative mood, but the meaning, hold on a second, meaning does not equal give info. The meaning is not to give information or assert something, right? The meaning is more like making a suggestion. Maybe we can get together for dinner. Let's go back to it. That's what's going on here. Shirley is making sure that, you know, he's around for Christmas, the boyfriend from out of town. Jerry says, yeah. And she says, good, maybe we can get together for dinner. So making a suggestion here, but putting it in the form of a statement as if she is asserting something here. Let's look at another one. Okay, so same thing going on here with the transcription details. In this one, we've got Emma has announced to her little sister, Lottie. So Emma and Lottie, the two people in this conversation here are sisters. So Emma has announced to her little sister Lottie that her husband walked out on her the night before. So Emma's husband has left. She is worried about the upcoming Thanksgiving dinner. Emma is worried about the upcoming Thanksgiving dinner she is planning to have for her daughter, Barbara. So Emma starts here this, well, anyway, that's the deal. So I don't know what to do about Barbara because you see she was depending. Lottie says overtops that with yeah. Emma says him taking her into the LA depot. She makes a sort of repair here, depot, Sunday. So he says, and then Lottie, over top of he says, Lottie says, I'll take her in Sunday. And Emma starts off with, no, oh, no, Lottie. Oh, my God, no, Lottie. And here, this transcription has arrows for the pitch here. And you can see this one, Lottie has something like a yeah, like that, kind of rising and then falling. And Emma says, no, that's a hell of a long trip. And Lottie starts with why. Emma says, oh, no, I wouldn't think of it, dear. And Lottie says, well, it actually only takes about 40 minutes, and says it's something like that. And Emma says, oh, no. So now let's look at what's going on here. I'll take her in. I'm going to put on in parentheses there. I mean, it's not in the, I'll take her in Sunday. What's the form here? Or prefer. Yeah, I can go back. Yeah. Remember, this is highly generalized here. But yeah, which one does it fit into here? Yeah. Declarative? Yeah, it's a statement. She says, what does she say? I'll take her in on Sunday. It's declarative. Yeah. It's a suggestion, perhaps. Although I'm not exactly sure it is a suggestion, considering the situation here. It seems more like, yeah, we could probably say that it's maybe a suggestion, although maybe even more forceful than a suggestion. Maybe like an order. Or maybe this one does fit the form function table, and it's body. So maybe it fits our, I'll go back again real quick. Maybe it fits our form function relationship here in that it's a statement. And it's Lottie asserting something. She's asserting that she will take her in, because remember what the social situation is here. Emma's husband left her, and Emma's worried because there's a Thanksgiving dinner she's planning to have for her daughter, Barbara. And Barbara comes up. Barbara is the one that was supposed to have it be taken to the LA Depot on Sunday by her father, or by Emma's husband, who has walked out. So Lottie says, I'll take her Sunday. And sort of Emma replies with, no, you can't do that. You know, this kind of stuff. And it's a long trip and whatnot. And Lottie replies with sort of, well, it actually only takes about 40 minutes. So sort of what you're saying is, you know, not going to change my mind. So it seems like she might be actually asserting something here. Hmm. Yeah, so sometimes it could fit like that. Okay. This is part of the... All right, I'm going to pause this here. This is homework for the next class. This is part of the second exam, which I didn't update the schedule on the Moodle page, but I have it, and I'll update it today. So I'll explain this for you. So if you, the part of the second exam is a pedagogical assignment, And you have to either create your own pedagogical assignment or modify a pedagogical assignment. And there's two chapters from the same book which discuss these things. So you'd read either chapter. So if you're planning on adapting an existing grammar exercise, or if you're depending on developing your own grammar exercise, then, if you're planning on adapting, then you read chapter 5. If you're planning on designing your own, then read chapter 9. This link will work if you're logged into the library, but the book is also linked to on our Moodle page. Hold on, Moodle page. At the top. Okay. Let's pause the recording.